Welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney.
And I'm Aaron Wary.
MPs are returning to work with the spring sitting getting underway on Monday. Government House Leader Peter Van Loan and NDP Leader Thomas Mulcair tell us what to expect.
Prime Minister Stephen Harper made his first official trip to Israel. McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru tells us what the Prime Minister was able to achieve.
Is there or is there not an iPod tax? Nearly a year ago, the government did battle with economist Mike Moffat about the issue. We'll let you know what new details he's discovered and try to clear up the confusion about the tariffs you may have to pay just to listen to some tunes.
And NDP MP Olivia Chow sits down with John Geddes to discuss her new memoir and her possible plans to become mayor of Toronto.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
The winter parliamentary break is finally coming to an end, meaning MPs from across the country are making their way back to Ottawa. With the Senate scandal filling the spotlight, the Conservatives were glad to say goodbye to 2013. But what's in store for 2014?
Well, to talk about the legislative priorities, I'm joined by Government House Leader Peter Van Loan. Mr. Van Loan, what can Canadians expect in terms of new legislation in the spring sitting?
Well, the focus of our government's agenda remains on the economy, job creation, and long-term prosperity. That means the cornerstone of the spring session will be the introduction of a new budget focused on continuing our low-tax plan for jobs and growth. We're well on our way to balancing the budget, eliminating the deficit in 2015, and we've had a very successful track record of creating jobs, so I expect you'll see more of the same. And there will be legislation, of course, after that to implement the budget.
Will there be another set of massive implementation bills like we've seen in the past?
It's normal that every year a budget is introduced and then it is then implemented. We've done it in two separate budget implementation bills, one in the spring and one in the fall. And that, of course, is the same pattern that's been followed by governments before ours, and I expect you can see the same this year.
Okay, so aside from the budget, what specific new legislation are you pushing through this spring?
Well, as I said, job creation and economic growth is the top priority, so we'll continue to work in that direction. Another priority is tackling crime agenda that we have. We've got a number of bills that are still on the order paper, but new legislation will include this spring the introduction of a victim's Bill of Rights, and we'll also be bringing forward legislation to deal with tougher sentences for child sexual predators.
And what about Michael Chong's reform bill? Where is that in the process, and will the government try to seek out amendments?
Well, it's actually not yet part of the order of precedence. There will be an intake of new private members' bills shortly after we return, but Mr. Chong is not yet included in that, so I don't expect his bill will even be up for debate until sometime very late in the spring for the first time.
So will the government push for amendments?
Well, we're certainly looking for the responses of members of Parliament to what they think of it.
I'm going to turn to the prostitution laws now that were struck down by the Supreme Court at the end of last year. Will the government put forward its new prostitution laws in the spring, or will it try and quickly pass it in the fall session?
I don't expect anything in the immediate short term. The Supreme Court has provided a year for a legislative response, so I know that Mr. McKay will want to get it right. That means looking closely at what the Supreme Court has actually said in its decision and what scope that gives for an appropriate response.
Now, over the winter break, an ice storm in Toronto caused travel nightmares for many passengers over the holidays. That sparked renewed talk of an air passenger bill of rights, something your government teased before the throne speech but never actually followed through with. So is that now completely off the table?
I think that's something that you're best to talk to the Minister of Transport about. I think, though, when we look at emergencies or natural calamity such as that ice storm, I don't know that there's anything you can do to legislate against the consequences of that kind of natural disaster. What we have to do, of course, is find ways to be able to respond to them rather than try and pretend that we can somehow deny they exist or make it the airline's fault that there was an ice storm.
Finally, the Senate scandal. It filled the headlines in 2013, and the opposition promises to keep pressuring the government on this topic, one that sent your numbers down in polling. Is there any way you can even combat that if we see new details come to light this spring?
Of course, the government doesn't decide the headlines, the media do, but I can tell you, for example, through the budget consultations I've done recently, the kinds of things we're working on, our focus on the economy is very much in sync with what I'm hearing from ordinary Canadians, and they themselves acknowledge frustration that you don't see the same interest in the national media in the importance of economic growth and job creation that they themselves have. But that being said, we're going to focus on those things that matter to Canadians and the things on which we've made commitments to them.
Now, NDP leader Thomas Mulcair is also here to talk about 2014, and let's start with the budget. What are you hoping to see in the fiscal plan from the Conservative government?
Last fall, the Conservatives promised that they would discover the importance of taking care of consumers. We were going to get a passenger's bill of rights for airlines. We were going to get all sorts of measures that were supposed to make life more affordable. The only problem is they never did any of those things. So we're going to be talking about affordability, everything from gouging on credit card interest rates to what people are paying at the gas pump that's often the result of collusion amongst gas companies. The NDP is going to be holding their feet to the fire, asking them why they're doing nothing to protect consumers and to make life more affordable.
Now, they have done some things when it comes to wireless rates, and they're trying to push through on those things, especially when it comes to roaming. So to be fair, I mean, they have taken some consumer-friendly measures.
What's interesting about the Conservatives is that they sometimes talk about doing things, but they never quite get around to actually doing them. We raise the issue of what's called pay-to-pay. Some companies, for phone bills or hydro bills, were charging an extra $2 to get a paper copy of your bill to be able to pay it. Well, we knew that that was unfair. We fought against it. The Conservatives said we were right and they would remove them. But you know what? They haven't done it yet. So we're still fighting, and we're going to make sure that we continue to require that the Conservatives don't just talk about protecting consumers, that they actually get it done.
So what new private members' bills is the NDP hoping to put forward this spring?
Well, we tend to forget that 60% of Canadians live paycheck to paycheck. So these affordability issues with regard to payday loans and the usurious rates being charged there, the very high credit card rates that keep people in a cycle of indebtedness that make Canadian households the most indebted in the OECD, those are the types of things that the NDP is going to be putting on the table for the next election. That's why I've been on a tour of Canada for the past week, talking to people from Sault Ste. Marie to Edmonton about the fact that under the Conservatives, life has gotten more expensive and that there are indeed things that we can do to make life more affordable for the average Canadian family.
Now, the affordability tour, that's a new focus on consumer issues for the NDP. Why the switch?
Well, don't forget, the NDP has been rolling out elements of its program for 2015, and we want Canadians to take a good look at what we're proposing. Before Christmas, I had the opportunity to put a very detailed energy policy on the table. Now we're giving specific elements of what we're going to be proposing to Canadians in the 2015 election. We think that that's the way to do politics, to say honestly what you're planning to do and let people decide. The Liberals, on the other hand, say that they have no ideas whatsoever and that they won't be telling Canadians anything until the next campaign. So that's a major difference between us. We think the Canadians have a right to debate ideas, and that's why we're not shy about putting ours on the table.
Speaking of the Liberals, Justin Trudeau has been talking about helping the middle class since his leadership campaign. Is this the NDP effort to try and do battle with the Grits on their own turf?
Well, you know, actions speak louder than words. The Liberals talk a good game when it comes to middle-class jobs, and yet Justin Trudeau's in favor of the Keystone XL pipeline that would export 40,000 good-paying Canadian jobs to the United States. We would prefer to keep those jobs in Canada.
And what about the Senate scandal? You've promised to keep this issue in the headlines when Parliament returns, but there's a possibility that charges will not be laid. And if we don't get any new shocking details, and how do you do that?
Well, prior to Parliament resuming last October, a lot of people were asking whether or not the issue was still alive. And I think that by the time Christmas rolled around, Canadians realized that we still hadn't gotten the truth from Stephen Harper on the Senate, so we're going to keep going.
But if it doesn't develop like it did in the fall and you keep hammering away at this, do you risk making Canadians sick and tired of hearing about this and tuning you out?
Canadians want to know what happened. These are accusations of criminal behavior in the Prime Minister's own office. This is the Conservative Party, people like Senator Gerstein. These are Conservative appointments, Mike Duffy. This is what we're talking about, Stephen Harper. He doesn't like to acknowledge that he's responsible, but he has sole responsibility here. He's got to stop trying to make this about his former employees.
So that's what the politicians have to say about all of this. But what about our McLean's think tank? Joining us for the panel this week is John Geddes. John, what are the major challenges and opportunities for the main political parties this spring?
Well, starting out with the Prime Minister, I guess the biggest challenge is that I've never seen him come into a period in politics where so much of the agenda is clearly out of his control. And by that, I mean particularly parts that are in the hands of either the courts or the police, right? He's got a Supreme Court of Canada decision coming down on the Senate, a Supreme Court of Canada decision coming down on his own appointment to the court, Marc Nadon. There are investigations going on into Senate spending, and still hanging out there, the robocalls investigations. So I think a lot of the news in the term could be things that he just has zero control over. These are things that are coming out of other parts of the sort of, you know, the broader political landscape, not the kind of controlled part of the landscape that he's always dominated in the past. So I think that's the first thing he's got to worry about, is things coming out at him that he can't really, you know, he can't pick the timing, and he certainly can't define the content of them.
Is it a chance for them to turn around, though, with things in the Senate scandal sort of dying down, with a lack of new information coming out? The narrative this week, at least, has been on his trip to Israel, which is something I think the Conservatives wanted the media to focus on.
Yeah, I think there's obviously some opportunities now for them to recapture things. They'll have a budget. They'll get to put some new policy on the table. They'll be able to make some moves here and there. But we have to assume, I think, at this point, that there will be more on the Senate scandal. There will be more documents. There will be a decision on charges. You know, I don't think that is quite done yet. And beyond that, to add to John's point, you know, we're looking at, there has to be a decision on the F-35 still. Keystone is still out there. There are so many of these issues that are now hanging around that are difficult to navigate for them, that the challenge is that much greater. You know, a government even coming off a good year would have a hard time sort of dealing with everything that's out there. And this is a government coming off of what I think by any measure was a pretty bad year.
So that's the government. Let's look at the NDP and the Liberals. What are the problems for the opposition moving forward?
Well, to start with the NDP, I think the challenge for Mulcair is obvious. He spent 2013 failing while succeeding, right? He established really dominance in question period most of the time, and yet never moved the NDP poll numbers up while doing that. That has to be enormously frustrating for him, and I think that's why we've seen him trying to add some different dimensions to his political persona in the last little while, particularly taking on consumer issues and stuff like that really doesn't have anything to do with his forte, which has been attacking the Prime Minister. In a way, he's in the classic dilemma of an opposition leader. Opposition leaders tend to attract attention when they draw blood from a Prime Minister, and yet doing that doesn't necessarily make voters view them as prime ministerial themselves. So this is where Mulcair kind of finds himself trapped at this moment, I think.
And what about Justin Trudeau?
I think he still has to prove his seriousness to a certain degree. You know, he obviously has some huge advantages right now, polling number-wise, fundraising-wise, just the sort of default amount of attention that he will draw to himself that gives him an advantage over Mulcair in that regard. The Liberals, though, now have to move into, I think, that period of sort of rounding out the picture. So you may like Justin Trudeau, but, you know, here's exactly what he's going to do. Here are the policies that prove he's serious.
So we had Government House Leader Peter Van Loan discuss the Reform Act, which was brought forward by Michael Chong. It's something that the government appeared to not enjoy when it first came out, obviously. And he chose his words a little bit differently there. What can we take from that?
Yeah, I don't know if this is an indication that they're maybe sort of going to not come out and attack it. Peter Van Loan seemed fairly critical of it in at least one interview in the fall. So maybe they're sort of softening their stance. We'll see how they kind of play this over the next few weeks. But I do think that one way or the other, the Reform Act hangs over this parliament now. And almost every discussion about how things are going is going to be with that in mind. And so, you know, the debate on it is months off, and a resolution to how that bill is whether or not it's going to be passed or not is even longer off. But this bill now sort of hangs over the discussion. And anyone watching parliament now has something in mind of a possible change ahead.
I'd just say, add to that tactically the Conservatives have to be looking and thinking that maybe shifting attention to the House of Commons is a way to get it away from the Senate, which has been a losing for them. So even if they don't like the content of Chong's bill precisely, they've got to like the idea of shifting the focus a bit. So maybe they end up making it work for them that way.
And they can always make amendments when it gets to the committee level and ask their members on the committee to try and change things, right?
Yeah, there is that theory. I mean, I guess you could look at what happened to Brent Rathgaber's bill and say that that's what could happen to Chong's bill. I think that would be a very risky play for them at this point to in any way be seen to be exercising too much executive control over a bill that actually deals with the idea of executive control. I think that would be a bit of a powder keg to potentially deal with. And especially if there is any amount of considerable support for that bill on the conservative side. If there are a number of conservative MPs who support that bill, the government has to be mindful of that and not antagonize their own caucus.
Thank you very much for your thoughts and analysis. Coming up, we discuss the Prime Minister's trip to Israel, an iPod tax, and Olivia Chow joins us for a discussion on her life in politics.
This week, Prime Minister Stephen Harper made his first official trip to the Middle East, visiting Israel, the West Bank, and Jordan. He arrived to adoring crowds and became the first Canadian Prime Minister to address the Israeli parliament. That speech was overshadowed by a pair of Arab-Israeli politicians who heckled the Prime Minister as he suggested that much criticism of the Israeli government is a new form of anti-Semitism.
On some campuses, intellectualized arguments against Israeli policies thinly mask underlying realities, such as the shunning of Israeli academics and the harassment of Jewish citizens. Most disgracefully of all, some openly call Israel an apartheid state. Now think about that statement. Think about the twisted logic and outright madness.
Aside from that blip, the government may have achieved many of its goals for this visit. I'm joined now by Maclean's senior editor and foreign correspondent Michael Petru for his take. So, Mike, first of all, why did Stephen Harper make this trip to Israel?
I think there were two broad themes that were driving this trip, internationally and then domestically as well. I think internationally, support for Israel has been a real foundation of Prime Minister Stephen Harper's foreign policy ever since he's been Prime Minister. And it dovetails nicely with other foreign policy trends, a hard line against Iran, support for democracies and also a hard stand against Islamist extremism. So he could, those three trends combined with a strong support for Israel itself could all be addressed in one trip. And this is something that he hasn't done in 8 years as Prime Minister. So it was clearly overdue given the importance that he's placed on Israel and Canada's relationship with Israel. Domestically, conservatives will often say that there is a price for their support for Israel, that it comes with a cost. They mention the larger numbers of Canadian Muslims and Canadian Jews. I don't doubt for a minute that Stephen Harper's support for Israel is heartfelt, but I don't buy the altruism angle completely. I think the very size of the entourage that accompanied the Prime Minister, including some questionable people, I think it must be said as well, an anti-gay pastor, a member of the ultra-nationalist Jewish Defense League, combined with some 200 other people, I think demonstrates that Stephen Harper also had an eye as to how this would play out in ridings at home. And I think for proof, we don't need to look any further than Mark Adler's rather pathetic pleading to be included in a photo op at the West Wall, which we're now supposed to believe was all in jest. So I think he had two goals. There were international themes that he wanted to address, and there was also the domestic consumption which I think motivated his trip as well.
Obviously, he was warmly received. Why do you think Benjamin Netanyahu was so eager to have him there?
Well, Israel has come under a lot of criticism internationally from Europe, but most importantly, I think the relationship between Benjamin Netanyahu's government and the administration of U.S. President Barack Obama is extremely rocky. I know that Israeli officials are frustrated with the United States, and Canada by no means can even come close to replacing the United States. I think that we need to recall that our influence and our ability to shape events in the Middle East is limited, especially compared with the United States, which really is an irreplaceable partner for Israel. But nevertheless, when some of your other friendships are fading, the ones that you do have, I think, appear all the more bright. And Canada is a bright friend and a strong friend for Israel right now. So I think, given the lack of international colleagues that Canada has in that regard, I think Netanyahu certainly values the support he's getting from Stephen Harper's government.
Obviously, Israel got the most amount of attention in terms of Harper's trip. Was there anything sort of to take away from the rest of that, his time in the Middle East?
I think so. I mean, we focused a lot on his time in Israel, of course, but he was also in the West Bank and Jordan. And I think that's important to recall that the Prime Minister's support for Israel has been perhaps, and his whole stand on the Middle East has perhaps been a bit of a tonal departure. I mean, his expression of friendship and admiration is louder than his predecessors. But there hasn't been a structural change. I mean, the official policy of Canada is that the settlement of the West Bank is a violation of the Geneva Convention, that the West Bank is occupied territory. Canada does not recognize the annexation of East Jerusalem. This hasn't changed under Stephen Harper. So we're not talking about a revolution. There's been changes in UN voting patterns. I think that's important to point out. But Stephen Harper hasn't overhauled Canada's policy towards the Middle East at all. And regarding the West Bank, Palestinian Authority, and Jordan, there was over $60 million of aid for the Palestinian Authority. This was a slightly reduced, but still, this is a sizable donation. And to Jordan, he's just announced over $100 million in funding. And I think this dovetails with Stephen Harper's desire to, and Canada's desire, I think, to support the Syrians who have suffered from the ongoing civil war there, without explicitly backing one of the many factions in the war there. So the $100 million goes a long way towards helping ease some of the burden that Jordan has shouldered by housing an enormous number of the refugees from Syria. So again, just to underline that point, I mean, Canada's support for Israel has not meant an abandonment of the Palestinians or indeed our Arab allies. There's been a tonal departure, but he hasn't revolutionized the way Canada approaches the Middle East.
Thank you, Michael. Coming up on the show, Olivia Chow opens up about her life before politics, and we talk about an iPod tax with Mike Moffitt.
When we say the words iPod tax, it makes almost everyone cringe. But there's been a year-long battle between a business professor and the federal government about whether or not there's actually an iPod tax on its way. To try and clear up the confusion and explain this complex tariff change, Paul Wells speaks with Mike Moffitt with the Ivy Business School at Western University.
Tell us the story about this iPod tax.
Yes, when the budget came out last spring, the conservative government made a number of changes to how tariffs are treated from a number of countries such as China, India, South Korea, and so on. The difficulty was that they didn't really explain these changes or how these changes would affect consumers. So I took a number of steps to try and figure out exactly which tariffs were going up. So I wrote a number of pieces, and I said, okay, well, I've discovered that the tariffs on bicycles are going up and coffee makers are going up and so on. And when I was going through the tariff schedule after about a week, I found some tariff item and that I didn't understand. So I started to do a little research, and it turned out it was MP3 players. So the tariff on MP3 players that were made in China and India and so on was going from 0% up to 6%. Well, iPods are manufactured in China. So what this means is when the tariff goes up, and it doesn't go up till 2015, but when that tariff goes up, all of a sudden there's an iPod tax. So I wrote this piece for the Globe and Mail, you know, thinking it would give a bit of a chuckle, ha-ha, here's a little iPod tax. And the government did not react to it too kindly.
So you wrote this piece for the Globe and Mail saying, ha-ha-ha, the government has introduced an iPod tax. It was funny because the NDP had proposed a fairly substantial iPod tax a few years ago, and the conservatives came down on them like a ton of bricks. And now they were doing a version of the same thing. So you wrote that, and then what happened?
sort of what I expected to happen is that the government would simply say, well, this isn't our intention, so naturally we'll make sure this doesn't happen, end of story. That is not how the government reacted. So how the government reacted was to basically do a whole media campaign, including press releases from the finance department, stating that my analysis was incorrect. And why it was incorrect is because there's this obscure provision in the tariff code that goes actually back to the Mulroney era that allows for computer parts to be imported into countries duty-free. So what you could claim as an importer is that an MP3 player somehow is a computer part, apply this special tariff code, and bring these items in duty-free. Therefore, there was no iPod tax.
And yet you were able to establish that that there was such a tax, and that the obscure provision didn't negate it. But by this point, the Globe and Mail had already run a correction for your story.
Right. So what had happened is I had received a phone call from the Globe and Mail that night saying, well, Mike, we have to pull the piece, but don't worry, we'll look again in the morning and we'll do a review and see where we are from there and make a plan from there. And I said, okay, well, that seems reasonable to me. And I guess what had happened is the Globe and Mail had received a number of complaints that, you know, this article had just sort of disappeared into the memory hole. So unfortunately, how the Globe and Mail decided to respond was to replace my piece with a two-sentence statement basically saying that the facts of the piece were incorrect, and therefore the article itself was incorrect and has been scrubbed from the website, and there is no iPod tax. And unfortunately, I learned about that sort of secondhand when a reporter called me and said, you know, what was wrong with your piece? I said, well, as far as I know, nothing was wrong with it, you know, just that there's this disagreement. So the Globe and Mail at that point invited me to write a second piece describing, you know, what I had found and who I had talked to. And that sort of thing. Now, so this whole thing about this 9948 is the government was making this claim that if you could plug it in, anything you could plug into a computer is therefore a computer part and comes in tariff-free. To me, that didn't make any sense. So, they, you know, I wasn't entirely sure if they were right about iPods, but that argument didn't really hold water to me because my first thought was, well, you can plug a car into a computer. Any car manufactured since 1997 legally has to have the ability to be plugged into a computer to get emissions data. Well, so I can't start importing Acuras from Japan and claiming them duty-free. So obviously, there has to be a line. So my thought was, I'll find out where that line is, and if I was wrong about the iPod tax, you know, I'll write a mea culpa piece. What I ended up discovering is that Sony and Panasonic and a number of companies had actually tried for years to import televisions and other consumer electronics, including MP3 players manufactured in places like Japan that already face a tariff on these items, had basically made the same argument that the government made. The CBSA didn't buy that argument and retroactively fined them $16 million. So what you basically had was the finance department publicly stating the same arguments that Sony had tried to use months before that the CBSA quashed. So you essentially had finance undermining CBSA in CBSA's ongoing tax dispute with Sony and Panasonic and Walmart and a number of other companies.
So let's fast forward a little bit. More recently, you found something that is perhaps particularly disturbing or surprising, which is that the government had received advice to the effect that what you originally wrote was accurate, and it seems to have ignored that advice.
Yeah, so there was a number of back-and-forth communications. So what I did was I filed an access to information request, and I filed a number of them. Some of them I filed to finance, and some of them I filed to the CBSA. And most of the ones I got back were so heavily redacted, they weren't all that useful. But this weekend, I received one that was nearly 400 pages, and almost nothing was redacted. And in those emails, it has internal emails between members of the CBSA, and as well as internal emails between CBSA and finance. So the day my piece came out, a number of people at the CBSA seemed to have a very long evening trying to talk finance down from this, saying, that's not how the rules have been interpreted, that's not how we've been doing it. And as well, there are specific references to me in my piece saying that, in fact, that the piece was accurate. I think that the term they used was, this is bang on, or I think another one was practically flawless or something along those lines. So it was very, very interesting to see CBSA so vehemently disagree with finance and try and talk finance down, saying, no, that's not how these regulations are interpreted. You're on the wrong path here.
Okay. So the practical effect for the consumer, if I bought an iPod today, would I have paid a tax on or a tariff on it?
Today, no, because the tax changes don't apply until 2015. But if you did buy an MP3 player that was manufactured in, say, Japan or Taiwan, you would pay one. And in fact, Sony has already paid one. So that's the big problem here, isn't so much of whether or not this tax exists, but rather that the government can't agree in and of itself that it exists. That basically finance to this day is saying, no, there's no tax on MP3 players because of the special provision, while at the same time, CBSA has assessed a tax on MP3 players to Sony, and to my knowledge, has not returned that money. So it's very strange to have one government agency say, no, this tax does not exist, where the other agency is, to my knowledge, actively enforcing it and has not returned Sony's money.
The Federal Finance Department has responded to the claims made by Moffitt. A spokesperson says discussions with bureaucrats are not government policy, and iPods have always entered Canada tariff-free. The government says it will ensure it stays that way. Coming up, we speak with Olivia Chow about her life in politics.
On Tuesday, former Liberal Prime Minister Jean Chrétien held a large party in Toronto to celebrate his 80th birthday and his decades in public service. It was a who's who of Canadian politics, with famous figures of all parties paying tribute to the longest-serving Prime Minister still alive. Speaking to Maclean's, Chrétien says he was happy with the turnout.
No, it's good. You know, it shows that the political profession is a very noble profession. You know, it's... People love to dump on politicians. But I like to say that I've been around for 40 years, and I've been around the globe, and we are probably the best political crowd of any country in the world. Very honest, very dedicated.
Well, from a political legend to a politician that all Canadians know, John Geddes, you interviewed Olivia Chow, Toronto MP and the widow of Jack Layton, about her new memoir called My Journey. What was that conversation like?
Very relaxed conversation, Cormac. We spoke for more than an hour in her Parliament Hill office, and a lot of Canadians, of course, know her either as Layton's widow or from her various political incarnations. But we started out talking about her moving to Canada from Hong Kong with her family when she was just 13. Here's some of the conversation.
Very few of us, I would think almost no one, is going to know anything about your childhood and upbringing. And those chapters, for me, were quite engrossing. Can you say something about the decision to write about what have to be... You have some happy childhood memories, but you write about some quite painful ones, I'm sure.
Mum and Dad, like all immigrants, couldn't find a job. I came to Canada when I was 13. They were professionals. My mum, from a school teacher, became a hotel maid. My dad drove taxi, delivered Chinese food. Yeah. How I managed those really difficult period is really the core of my faith, of learning about unconditional love and all that. So I needed to go into it in order to explain later on how I managed it.
How about the specific point, though, of your father having gone through periods when he was quite abusive to your mother?
His mental illness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it needs to be talked about because I found it was so difficult to get help for him then. Mm-hmm. it's still really difficult to get help now.
Yeah.
For young people, for newcomers, mental health, it's an area that the services are so fragmented. And I don't wish anyone gone through what I went through as a teenager, trying to find a psychiatrist for my dad. Was it the right decision?
Yeah.
It was full of self-doubt. And it's important to talk about mental health and domestic violence because many other people experience it.
Most Canadians got to know Chow when she was Jack Layton's partner. Of course, I asked about that. And one thing I wondered was that given that they're both very strong political personalities, if there was ever a feeling of rivalry between them. She cut me down pretty quickly on that one.
No, none whatsoever.
Well,
because the main goal is to get something done for others, right? It's to build affordable housing, let's say, okay? So he has one way of building it, and then I can contribute in a different way, and the goal is to build affordable housing. It's not the goal that I'm a better person or better politician, I can win this or not win that. As to who leads it, who cares who leads it? Who cares who gets the credit for winning something? It doesn't matter.
Jack Layton had gone through prostate cancer treatment before the 2011 campaign, and the NDP, of course, scored a big breakthrough in that election. A few weeks later, Layton was diagnosed again with cancer. There have been questions about when exactly he knew and when she knew that he was sick again. It felt awkward asking about that, such a sensitive personal thing, but Olivia Chow seemed pretty comfortable answering.
Can you talk about what your feelings were during that campaign? Were you worried about him overtaxing himself?
No, it was fine. No, I wasn't worried at all.
You thought he wasn't overdoing it?
No. He had his sister. They were in the gym 45 minutes a day at least.
Yeah.
So a few occasions I joined them. I watched how they did the gym thing. I said, oh, Jack is doing much better, right? He went from 20 minute on the bike to 40 minute on the bike. I thought, all right, okay.
Yeah.
And also, there's this thing called leap of faith. It's coming back to my faith that if you can connect with people, believe that they will connect, that they want the best for themselves and for their country and for the kids. Mm. When you believe that they have that element inside them, if you connect with them, then things will happen.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain how it could why it happened, but it is, again, back to my early training, is that leap of faith, that you do what you can, connect as much as possible, and it will happen. Mm-hmm. And it did in that time.
In retrospect, people have wondered whether or not Jack and you, of course, would have known already at that point that there were questions about his health. You're saying no. There was
No. The pain that he later on experienced was later in June. I forgot.
In July.
End of June.
Yeah.
Mid-June, I think. I've forgotten. Yeah, mid to late
that,
June.
I believe you say in the book that he had an appointment on the 28th of June or something.
Yeah, that's
that
right.
Point.
Because with the doctor, we tend to do the doctor's appointment follow our parliamentary calendar.
Right.
So we thought, we'll check it out later. We'll do the test later, and we were moving into Stornoway. We didn't have enough time to pack and unpack. And then...
Forgive me for dwelling on this, but
yeah,
I know
fine.
People will be interested in it. You're saying that between the end of the campaign and all that, you described that fun period, a buoyant period between the campaign in late June, and those doctor's appointments he would have had in late June or early July. You're saying there wasn't some inkling you had that, well, he's sick again, or he's getting... You didn't have that situation.
There was at the... I've forgotten exactly when, but it's sometime in June. Mm. His hip was hurting. I thought, is it the other hip? Which hip was it? I've forgotten which hip he had surgery on. So I said, why are you still using the cane? And I thought it was arthritis. His mom had arthritis, and I thought it was overlying. So we thought that it was the pain in that leg. Mm. We thought it was you know, related to the bike accident. So we thought, okay, we'll wait till later. But then it just gotten worse.
Yeah. Who do you lean on now? How do you get through routine days? Do you have particular?
I have Mike Layton.
Mike's a big part of your life.
Mike Layton is, he's like fish in water. Because he was never political when he was a kid. Right. And even when I shouldn't call him a kid anymore. He's once a kid, always a kid. and he is very, very good. He has that sense of, there's not one mean bone in his body. Mm-hmm. And he's always see the best of every single person. So it's so much like that.
There's a lot of speculation these days that Chow will run for mayor of Toronto next fall. We finished our conversation with me asking her about that, and she was so direct in her answer that I have to assume she's very likely to take the plunge.
I'm seriously considering it, and I'm talking to friends and families. When I make the decision, you know, I'll let
you
folks know.
Call me first, right?
And in Toronto, deserve... let me put it the other way. I want to make sure my grandchildren and other people's kids have a better role model than Rob Ford.
That's McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes with Olivia Chow. Now, before we go, Aaron, we have a piece in the current edition of McLean's about the Keystone XL pipeline. Why don't you tell me a little bit about it?
That's right. In this week's issue, Washington correspondent Louisa Savage offers the definitive account of how the Keystone XL pipeline became the focal point of the energy debate and a challenge to relations between Canada and the United States. And next Friday, Louisa's documentary on the pipeline premieres on CPAC at 9 p.m. Eastern. We'll have Louisa on next week's show to discuss what she found when she set out to tell the story of Keystone XL.
I'm looking forward to it. Well, that's it for this week's episode. We want to thank Government House Leader Peter Van Loan, NDP Leader Thomas Mulcair, Associate Professor at the Ivy School of Business Mike Moffat, and NDP MP Olivia Chow. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.